Welcome to The Freedom Line, the podcast for the Center for Individual Freedom, where we meet nonsense with common sense. Here's your host, Renee Giacchino.
Welcome to the Freedom Cast. My name is Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. Joining me again is my friend, former colleague, and attorney from Washington, D.C., Bill Conti. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you back. I know that a lot is changing and has changed in the political landscape, so it's always a pleasure to have you join me to talk about inside baseball, or in this case, inside the Beltway and a little bit outside the Beltway as we begin to move towards some primaries. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you, Renee, and it's always great to be with you, and I always love doing this with you, but let's get to it so you can get back to your higher priority at the moment of spending time with your beautiful new granddaughter.
Well, thank you. That is a real treasure. Well, let's talk first. You know, folks tuned in for another round of debates. We then saw, you know, at least one candidate drop. I want to start with Nikki Haley. Is she for real?
Is Nikki Haley for real? Yes, I would say the way a tempest in a teapot is real. Let's take a step back. And as always, we have to view this question like we have to view every other thing we confront in life through the lens of Donald Trump. So what you've really got to understand is that from the very start of this cycle and even before, the Republican establishment was, I don't think dying is too strong a word, for somebody from their ranks who could rise up and occupy that lane and take down Donald Trump and save us from the scourge. That would be another Donald Trump run for the presidency and possibly presidency. So we started, the early leader out of the gate was Tim Scott. He immediately received the blessing of Mitch McConnell and the Mitch McConnell crowd in the Senate. And of course, he got the corresponding great press. But early on, even before the performance that led him to just recently drop out, I think it became clear to people he wasn't going to fit the bill. So the next hope against hope from the Republican establishment became Glenn Youngkin in Virginia. They were going to convince Glenn Youngkin to run. You had all kinds of establishment donors going to him. He was getting all kinds of accolades, especially in the Wall Street Journal. And again, the hope was that he was going to run. And when he flipped Virginia from a blue state legislature, really divided, to a red one, he was going to show that he had the formula to move away from Donald Trump, win blue states, and everything was going to be well and good for the D.C. Republican establishment. And that was great until it didn't happen. And just the opposite happened. And I don't really see this as a big failure by Youngkin, but it was a failure under the narrative. And so even though, again, interestingly, the Wall Street Journal was writing all these articles about how he really didn't lose, he did lose. And that put a dent in him in the eyes of the Republican establishment as the possible savior. Now, simultaneously with the Youngkin adoration you were getting, Nikki Haley was at first quietly, steadily performing well in the debates, at least in the eyes of the Republican establishment people and the many in the media who share their desire to see one person emerge to take on Donald Trump head to head. Because, again, that's the narrative. Get Donald Trump head to head and you'll take him down. I think that ignores the reality of where the polling is right now. But nevertheless, that's the story. Haley has done reasonably well. She has moved up some in especially the early state polling. She really hasn't done much in the national polling. So she is showing some improvement. And without doubt, she is now the darling of the GOP establishment and the mainstream media for the Republican nomination. So, okay, that's nice. Where does that leave her? You know, could she pass DeSantis in Iowa, and could she pass him in and or New Hampshire? More likely New Hampshire. I guess she could. And of course, she'll get all the attendant great press if she does, just like John Kasich got for overperforming back in 2016. But where does that really leave her? Again, the narrative will be, well, when Trump falters, when Trump is taken down by these criminal cases or something, she'll be in second place and she'll come in and take away the nomination. I don't think that's even right. She may be in second place at some point, but even if Trump falters, his voters aren't going to go largely to her. They're going to go to Ron DeSantis, and all the polling shows that. And Ramaswamy's voters certainly aren't going to go to her. And while he's an interesting guy, he's kind of fun to watch, he certainly brings some entertainment factor, he's not going to be the nominee, but he's still, you know, he still has about 5-7% of the vote behind him. They're just not going to go to Nikki Haley. I just see this as a very, very difficult path for her. Now, may she be burnishing her credentials for the vice presidency, which was the, again, we're talking narratives, the narrative of her reason for running? Yeah, it could. And notwithstanding that, you know, they're throwing barbs at each other, and Trump has called her a bird brain, you know, those things always get put aside. Remember voodoo economics and Reagan and Bush, when Reagan picked Bush. Yeah, she could be a viable vice presidential candidate for him, and of course she would, you know, love to have it. So that's where I see Nikki Haley. I'll tell you this as a little bit of an aside. The one thing I don't understand about what she is doing is if she is trying to build on this media and institutional support of her as a real candidate, I don't see why she keeps picking fights with Vivek Ramaswamy. I understand she doesn't like him. I understand she thinks he's dangerous, and who knows, maybe she's right. But she's punching well below her stature in going after him, and all she's doing is strengthening him. I do not understand her obsession with him. So that's how I see Nikki Haley. As I said, she has made some improvement. I don't see her as a viable, you know, as viable for the Republican nomination. DeSantis would get it before her if Trump were to falter.
Let's cross the aisle, and I'll ask you the same question about another name that comes up frequently. I mean, we're not talking Biden. I mean, he's obviously the incumbent. But what about Gavin Newsom? Is he really up to it, or do you see as well potentially a very difficult path for him?
Oh, I see no path for him, and I think that's again, assuming Biden stays in the race. And I have said to you from the start, I see no reason for Biden to do anything else. I don't see him as deciding to get out. I guess he could for personal reasons. I think what Gavin Newsom is doing is sort of laying the foundation. He's playing two games at once. And I actually think he's playing it kind of well. Should Biden stumble, I shouldn't say stumble, suppose Biden wakes up one day and says, oh, God, I'm so old, I can't even get out of bed anymore. I don't know what city I'm in. I'm calling it a day and riding off into the sunset. Newsom has done a good job of bringing enough speculation upon himself that he'd sort of be ready to step right in. You know, he's not going to enter this race because he's thinking longer term, and he's not going to do what Dean Phillips is doing and risk alienating the entire Democratic Party over doing something like this. And the other thing Gavin Newsom is doing is if you are watching him closely, he is occasionally in relatively minor ways, sort of bucking the progressive left on certain things, saying no to them, you know, now and then in very strategically selected spots, which, you know, is building up the case. Hey, I'm not some crazy left wing, you know, progressive / socialist. I'm really a moderate. And doing that kind of stuff, again, will let the media basically claim, as they did with Obama, for example, oh, the guy's really a moderate. Don't you see what he did here? Don't you see what he did there? So I think Gavin Newsom long term is actually playing it quite smart within the Democratic Party. He's not going to mess with Joe Biden. Would he step in if Joe Biden, as I said, you know, said, no, I've had enough? Yeah, sure he would. And he's positioned himself well and well for that without giving the impression he is trying to take down Joe Biden. If anything, he has explicitly, repeatedly rejected the notion that he has any inclination to do it, and he will not do it.
Prediction still on it being a Biden-Harris ticket?
Unchanged. It will be a Biden-Harris ticket. I suppose Biden, you know, I'm saying it for the third time, could decide he's had enough. And what I think is happening on the Democratic side is, well, with the so you got Dean Phillips, but basically people are sort of dropping a lot of hints rather than trying to shove them out. And I think that's going to be as far as it goes. And it will certainly be Kamala Harris as his running mate. He will not mess with that. He cannot mess with that. The black woman is far too important a voter in the Democratic coalition. He cannot risk alienating them. The look would be awful, notwithstanding her problems, for better or for worse. I guess it's like a marriage. He's taking her for better or for worse, and he's got her now, and she isn't going anywhere. And it would be political suicide to try to get rid of her.
What about third-party runs? Any of that you see forming? Anything really going to have any legs?
Well, you know, I've never been a believer in RFK Jr., but that was always more in our discussions with him as a Democratic primary opponent of Joe Biden. He's now decided to go third party, and, you know, whatever damage he can do, I think he can do a lot more as a third party candidate, as the polling is showing, than as an opponent to Joe Biden in the Democratic primary. The guy's gotten a little bit of juice. I mean, he has. You can't deny it. Now, whether that's people just, God, I'm so sick of Joe Biden for whatever reason. He's old. I can't stand watching him falling down. I hate all this support for Israel. I'm, you know, on the far left, we're killing Palestinians. And whether they'll all come home come Election Day, that remains to be seen and is very possible. But RFK Jr. is going to have some effect, I think, as long as he gets on the ballot and stays there. Because in these super tight elections, as we've seen before with Ralph Nader, Jill Stein, very, very small amounts of votes can turn some of these states. And he's going to get more votes than either of them ever did, for sure. So the Democrats are worried about him and should be. And you know, read a lot of articles, a lot of analysis. Well, who's he going to take more votes for? He could take more votes from Trump. No, he's not. He's going to hurt Biden. Biden knows it. The Democrats know it. You don't see the Republicans freaking out over RFK Jr.'s potential presence on the ballot, and the Democrats are going nuts, which brings us to the bigger, better deal potentially in terms of driving Democrats nuts, and that's Joe Manchin or whoever no labels may pick. Again, just look at what they're saying. You don't hear any Republicans talking about, oh, Joe Manchin, you don't want to ruin your legacy. You don't want to be remembered this way. They're keeping their mouths shut thinking, no, Joe, you want to be remembered exactly this way. We want you on the ballot. And the Democrats know he is potentially very, very problematic for Joe Biden. And not just him. I mean, anybody they might run. Now, I do think he would be especially problematic if I'm sort of advising the Republicans, and they say, well, who would be the best guy from no labels to run against Joe Biden? Oh, it would be Joe Manchin. It would not be Larry Hogan. It would not be Mitt Romney. It would be Joe Manchin. I mean, Joe Manchin's basically a Democrat. Well, he's a Democrat, but he's a pretty liberal Democrat for all the talk about how he does slow up things from time to time. He votes with Joe Biden 88% of the time. Okay, it's not 100, but it's still a lot. And they are they're very concerned about Joe Manchin, and they should be. This is going to be, I do think, I usually don't get into the hyperbole, but I think this is going to be one of the more, I don't know what the right word is, chaotic, kind of exciting, wild presidential elections that we've seen in a long, long time, maybe ever. I mean, when you couple in the Trump criminal drama, the fact that it's very possible Trump could be campaigning as a quote-unquote convicted felon, there's been nothing ever close to this as far as I can tell.
Let's talk a minute. You mentioned Senator Joe Manchin, who has announced he is not running for re-election. And taking that discussion away from, you know, a potential presidential run and the impact that might have, How do you see that potentially impacting the Democratic hold on the Senate?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, they've lost. That state's gone. I mean, it was probably gone anyway. It was almost certainly gone anyway. Republicans, it looks like they're going to get Governor Jim Justice. And it was always baffling how Manchin held on to the seat. But the Democrats are up one, and now in 2024, the Republicans start with a one-seat lead. Okay, so that brings us to Sherrod Brown and John Tester, which are the next two. And really, the probably the only two really likely to flip, you know. It's going to be interesting. You know, everybody knows Sherrod Brown is a very liberal senator in what has become a very red state. But as we have seen, notwithstanding, again, what the media narrative is to blame everything on Donald Trump, it can be harder than people think to unseat these incumbent senators. I'm certainly not writing Brown off. He will be a formidable challenger. I think he's pretty popular in the state. So that'll be close. And the same with Tester. You know, again, the Republican establishment has its anointed one out there, which is a guy named, I believe it's Sheehy, young guy, entrepreneur, you know, nice military record, everything the Republican establishment, and maybe any Republican, would want in a candidate. But he does have a potential primary challenge, which hasn't been formally announced yet. But it looks like it's coming, that people think could get ugly and maybe damage him. So I wouldn't write Tester off either. It'll be close. They could certainly take either one of those or both. If I had to put my money on it, I certainly wouldn't bet. I wouldn't do a parlay, to use a gambling term, and link the two together and hope they win both. I'd pick one or the other. You know, the other state people look to is Pennsylvania, where this guy McCormick, again, another Republican establishment favorite, is going to go up against Bob Casey. I don't think that race is as viable as people act like it is. You would probably need a big win at the presidential level to carry him across the line. You know, and I don't think there are really any Republican seats that really are in play that could be Democratic pickups. The two that everybody points to are Ted Cruz in Florida. We've seen that play before. You know, somebody's going to be the next Beto O'Rourke. The Democratic donor base is going to burn tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to beat Ted Cruz, and he's going to win. And then the other guy they point to is in your state, Rick Scott. Similarly, good luck. You're not going to beat him. And so that's really the state of play in the Senate as I see it. You know, and the presidential election will be a big thing because that will drive the turnout, the top of the ticket, and in those particular states. And now all those states are states that Donald Trump will carry if he's the nominee, of course. And if you can hear the sarcasm in my voice, I wasn't trying to disguise it. But so that's the state of play in the Senate. You know, their grip on the Democrat grip on the Senate is very tenuous right now. Even if Biden is reelected, it's a good chance. There is a chance they won't have the Senate. Although the most likely, you know, it could be again another one of these 50-50 propositions. With Kamala Harris breaking the tie.
I know that you meant to say Ted Cruz from Texas. You said Florida, but I know you meant Texas, and then you referred to Rick Scott from my home state of Florida. So just I know you'd want that clarification. Bill, before we close out our discussion today, let's look at what happened recently in, you know, these off-year elections. Does that give us a sneak peek into anything? I mean, how reliable do you feel like, and is it just too far away? And I guess the follow-up to that would almost include as well a discussion of whether or not, you know, how important foreign policy is going to be. Is again, what's happening today as it relates to foreign policy too far to predict how that might impact something a year from now?
Well, let me take the second question first on, you know, will foreign policy be a voting issue? Because clearly there's a lot going on in the world. You can talk a lot about foreign policy right now. It's very important. But the only time foreign policy is a voting issue is when people aren't, you know, terribly concerned about the economy or Americans are dying overseas. That's not, neither of those things are the case right now. If these conditions exist on Election Day, I don't think foreign policy will be a voting issue. I think it will be the economy. You know, and that's another thing that I think cuts against Nikki Haley. Even worse, she to become the nominee. She's touting all this foreign policy expertise, which is nice and it's important. I don't think it's what's really foremost on people's minds, and I don't think it is what's going to vote, going to drive their choices in deciding who to vote for. So, you know, going back to the off-year elections, I always tend to call them midterms, which of course they're not. Well, you know, again, you have another better performance for the Democrats than for the Republicans, as is always the case. You have people out there blaming it on Donald Trump, Chris Christie first and foremost and loudest among them. You cannot hang this on Donald Trump. You can't. Donald Trump was minimally involved in this. The big high-profile losses had nothing to do with him, and if anything, would be held out as indications had these guys succeeded of the repudiation of Donald Trump. So that's number one. Number two, I often do say to you, Renee, that people put too much into these elections. You know, largely because people who write about politics need stories. They make good stories. I don't think you can dismiss them as harbingers. You should look at them. But as you say, it's a long way away. These were a couple of isolated elections. So you can't put too much into them. Now, getting to the specifics. You, of course, have the vote in Ohio, which was essentially an abortion referendum. Which once again, the advocates of abortion rights prevailed. Clearly, this is an issue for the Republicans. The decision in Dobbs has not helped them politically, even though I think any fair-minded person could look at what's going on now and have to congratulate the Supreme Court, whether you like how the politics are turning out or not. Dobbs was correctly decided. This issue belongs in the hands of the people, whichever way it turns out. Alito correctly recognized that. I think his statement that Roe was egregiously wrong is absolutely right. This issue is in the hands of the voters, which is where it belongs, not to the whim of five old, unelected, out-of-touch people. So that's, you know, number one. The other two big races, which were going to be held out as, you know, bellwethers, was the governor's race in Kentucky, where the Republican candidate, and his name escapes me now, running against Beshear, and again, who was going to be held out as the future of the new party, the post-Trump party, was a protege of Mitch McConnell. He was McConnell's former chief of staff, I believe. And he lost badly. Okay. That's, you know, that's, again, the media isn't calling it out that way, but that's a loss for the Republican establishment, as is Youngkin's failure, which we talked about earlier, to win those, you know, to turn both houses of the Virginia legislature red. Again, I think it's a reminder for all the media narratives you get of, you know, the post-Trump, the anti-Trump GOP, and how it needs to come back. Look, whether you like it or not, and I'm not endorsing it or condemning it, I have made the statement repeatedly. I will make it again. I think it's absolutely true. Without the Trump voter, there is no Republican Party as a viable political entity in 2023. There just is not. And anybody who thinks otherwise, I think, is, you know, as I like to say, the next plane from Fantasy Island leaves in 5 minutes. Get on it.
Well, Bill, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I'm already amassing our list of questions and discussion points for our next conversation, which we need to do before some of the primaries. Latest news out of New Hampshire is they've set their date for January 23rd to be, quote, first in the nation. We know that's the Democrats and President Biden. you know, are not happy with that. They're looking at South Carolina. So, I mean, a whole nother discussion we will have very soon. Before I let you go, any parting thoughts?
Yes, just you did trip something I was thinking of. The one thing, if you want to talk in terms of, you know, setting the media nuts in silly narratives, as a result of what you just described, you know, Biden is not on the New Hampshire primary ballot because he can't defy, or he doesn't, well, maybe he could, but he's just choosing not to defy the DNC and playing by the rules. So people are actually speculating as to whether Dean Phillips, and don't forget Marianne Williamson, who I like to call Tinkerbell, is still floating around out there in the Democratic Party, could actually, some people think, maybe as a result, win that primary. Now they are trying to organize an unofficial, you know, right Biden in campaign, so he would still win the primary. But if Phillips were to win that primary, I don't think he will. I think Biden would win even as a write-in. But were to Phillips win the primary, you know, the media would go absolutely, you know, cuckoo bananas, as my daughter likes to say to my young granddaughter, over that. So that's just something that could be happening. Will be a little bit amusing. If it happens, it won't make any difference. You know, one other note I would drop is people still think presidential elections and the primary battles are won like they are in 1968, when, you know, if the front runner falters even a little, like Lyndon Johnson did in New Hampshire, the party elders will come to them and say, well, you know, you got to get out. And they'll say, okay, I will. Boy, that's dead. If you want to know how important Iowa and New Hampshire are these days, just ask Joe Biden. He lost both of them badly, and last time I checked, he was the president. They just don't have the effect they once did. I actually think the Democratic decision to de-emphasize them was probably not an unreasonable one. Well, it was definitely not an unreasonable one. It was probably the correct one, putting partisan politics of the moment aside. They probably are not representative enough of states that they have this, or at least they used to have this disproportionate impact. But as I said, Biden lost them both badly. What difference did it make?
Very interesting. All right. Well, we will certainly be meeting again before some of those primaries take effect. Our guest has been Bill Conti. He's an attorney from Washington, D.C. and a political commentator. Thank you again, Bill, for all of your time today. We look forward to having you join us again soon.
Thank you, Renee. A pleasure as always.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.